Hey everyone, this is David Kern here. Just wanted to say a quick word from our friends over at Escondido Tutorial Service. Our culture needs more fine minds who have an understanding of the great ideas of Western civilization. The dying art of civil discourse is one that needs much practice and finesse, and your junior and high school students can hone this art through studying with 25-year veteran, Great Books tutor Fritz Heinrichs. His 5-year survey of the great books of the Western world includes works by Homer, Plato, Augustine, Calvin, Shakespeare, Dante, Chaucer, Dostoevsky, Kant, Freud, Marx, and C.S. Lewis. Each week, students meet for a 2-hour session discussing the reading and learning to dialogue with one another. They're required to write papers several times a semester as well. The opportunity for 2 free years of classical Greek is offered to students enrolled in grade books 2 and 3, while free Shakespeare accompanies year 4. 5th-year students write 2 3,600-word papers and present them online, answering questions from Mr. Heinrichs and the assembled fellow students. Those interested can join a 4-day gathering each June full of debate, reader's theater, singing, dancing, and fantastic fellowship. Guided by the joyful wisdom of Mr. Heinrichs and the great books, join a conversation full of truth, justice, love, and beauty. To find more how you can join the great conversation, please visit the Escondido Tutorial Service website today at gbt.org. Again, that is gbt.org. Welcome to Libromania, a podcast for the book obsessed from the Close Reads Podcast Network. I'm David Kern, and each week I'm chatting with authors, biographers, designers, collectors, critics, and other people who help make books so worthy of our attention. This is chapter 18, in which I chat with author Callie Fine about her experiences teaching Shakespeare and the book that came out of those experiences.
There was a line in the booklet that I used that said, don't worry about students getting it all at once, because none of us ever will. The point is to present it in such a way that they'll want to return to the story. And that just was enough for me. It was that, okay, we don't have to get this whole story. The idea is for them to hopefully look at it again, return to it again.
Callie Fine is a writer and teacher living in Ann Arbor, Michigan. She's a contributor for Coffee and Crumbs and T.S. Poetry Press, and her writing has been featured on Art House America, TweetSpeak Poetry, Good Letters, Alter Work, Relief Journal, and Off the Page. And she's the author of 2 books, Twirl, My Life with Stories, Writing, and Clothes, and The Teacher Diaries, Romeo and Juliet. And it's this last book that I wanted to talk to her about because it's all about teaching Shakespeare. But not in the sense that it gives, 15 tips for helping students understand Elizabethan language, or say 11 facts about the life of Shakespeare that will help you understand why Romeo fell in love with Juliet, or whatever. It's about her journey as a Shakespeare teacher. As much a literary memoir as anything else, the book tracks Callie's personal journey as she looks to help her students fall in love with Shakespeare. She's interested in helping them have a lifelong appreciation for the Bard, not just the ability to pass a test about him. And yeah, the book includes some of her tactics for doing that, but it's not a pedagogical handbook. It's the story of how her students learned to love something that seemed so foreign to them at first, and how that changed her along the way. So, I wanted to chat with her about that experience. We discussed the book, her work in classrooms with students who didn't seem capable of reading Shakespeare at first, the greatness of libraries, and as usual, much, much more. So, let's get to it. Here's my conversation with Callie Fine. Well, first of all, thank you for being here. It's a pleasure to talk to you and spend some time talking about, among other things, teaching Shakespeare. Because, because I first heard about you from John Wilson, the former editor of Books and Culture, and we were having a discussion about the best books, or his favorite books anyway. I necessarily want to say they're only the best books, because there's lots of great books that we didn't cover. But he was mentioning some of his favorite books of the last year, of 2018, and he mentioned that he had read The Teacher Diaries, your book about teaching Romeo and Juliet. And so I thought, man, I gotta talk to her as a fellow high school English teacher.
Okay. Yeah,
So I went and read the book, and it definitely, I can't decide if it was inspiring or if it gave me PTSD, but maybe a little bit of both.
Me too.
I'm sure the act of writing it was probably a little, little PTSD inducing, but also a little therapeutic. So absolutely. I'm curious, did you know coming out of college that you wanted to teach Shakespeare to high school students, or is that something you came to, like you were forced into it?
Yeah. Well, I knew coming out of college, I wanted to teach stories. I had been captured. I went to Calvin, and I knew that anybody could get me to learn anything if they presented it in a story. Hmm. And there was something about that. I probably couldn't articulate that in 1998, but I knew I wanted to teach stories, and I wanted to pull stories out of students. Hmm. So Romeo and Juliet, Shakespeare, I was a terrible student. And so I didn't really think I would have been capable of reading Shakespeare let alone teaching it. I don't know if I'd say I was forced into it, but it was part of the curriculum, and I put it off as long as I could.
Yeah.
Until I found another colleague of mine at the school that I was teaching Shakespeare at, suggested I use this curriculum from the Folger Theater. Hmm. And they presented teaching Shakespeare as more, play. And that I think there was a line in the booklet that I used that said, don't worry about students getting it all at once, because none of us ever will. The point is to present it in such a way that they'll want to return to the story. And that just was enough for me. It was that, okay, we don't have to get this whole story. The idea is for them to hopefully look at it again, return to it again. And so that was the attitude that I went in, and it helped me be a lot more creative and take a little bit more risks and also not worry so much about what the outcome was going to be.
Yeah. It's such I think freeing distinction that as literature teachers, or maybe in particular literature teachers, I don't necessarily know about the other disciplines, but you know, it's freeing to think about the idea that when we're teaching a book, our goal is not necessarily to make sure our students get it completely.
Right.
In some ways it's about, certainly about teaching them to be better readers, inspiring reading habits, you know, hopefully inspiring them to be lifelong students, showing them what it looks like to ask questions, things like that. Like, those are just as important as them. Well, they might be more important. I think they probably are, than getting them to just fill their head with a quote unquote, you know, understanding of a work of literature, because we don't even understand. I mean, we might understand parts of it, but we're never going to understand it completely. Mm-hmm. I mean, to varying degrees, I suppose. But did you find that once that distinction sort of occurred to you or became part of your teaching life, that it changed your relationships with your students and not just your relationship with the book?
Oh yeah. It absolutely. I mean, actually, you know, I taught that same year I taught To Kill a Mockingbird, which is my favorite book. And I mean, I named my children after people in the book. And I thought for sure that was going to be my...
Did you name your child Scout?
No, I named one Harper, and my other girl is named Hadley, and I wanted to name her Radley, but my husband said, you're taking it way too far. And I think he was afraid she was going to be named Boo.
Well, I have I have children named after characters in favorite books too. One of my kids is named Jeremiah, and we call him Jem.
So that's great.
Carry on. Sorry.
Well, anyway, so I thought for sure that was going to be the book that was going to do it for me and my students. And it turned out it was Romeo and Juliet. And I think part of it was I decided that a lot of what we were going to do was find other stories that followed this same arc. And we found Eleanor and Park. The Wednesday Wars by Gary Schmidt. And what we found was that there's always more going on than what meets the eye. And so we looked a lot about what love does, especially what it does for 12, 13, and 14 year olds, especially since they were the characters in the book, the main characters. And, we talked a lot about, you know, the definition of love and whether or not, you know, were they really in love? And I think we decided, you know what, it doesn't really matter, because they felt something and it did something to them. So, and I think that helps students feel like whatever they're going through was important and it mattered, and they needed to muddle through it despite whether other people were saying, you know, this is stupid, you're just in middle school, you can't really feel this way, or whatever it is. And so I think that story helped them with their own stories. Not that you know, the outcome was awful in Romeo and Juliet, but I think it at least helped them own up to what it is they were going through. And it's such a confusing time, and I was thankful for those characters, for them to be
what,
able to.
What grade was it? You said middle school?
It was eighth grade. Yeah, okay. We did it in eighth grade. I know a lot of people read it in ninth grade. Yeah. But for some reason, the school that I was teaching in did it in eighth grade. Hmm.
Are you still teaching at the same school?
No, that was a school right outside of Washington, D.C. Hmm. And now my title is at-risk literacy specialist, and I teach, I work in libraries, two libraries in the Ypsilanti, Michigan schools. Hmm. And so one is a pre-K through first grade, and the other one is a K through fifth grade school. Okay. And I basically read stories and help students check out stories and all that kind of stuff.
Well, so I want to talk to you about that the idea of stories with at-risk student or at-risk children. But let's hold off on that for a few minutes, because I want to keep talking about this. So you end up writing this book, The Teacher Diaries, and part of the Teacher Diaries series. So ostensibly, you're going to write. Are you going to write about more Shakespeare plays? Is that the idea? But
idea. Well, so what happened was I was supposed to be writing another book. And which ended up being Twirl, which is the one that came out in February. Mm-hmm. But my family, we'd made a move to Ann Arbor, Michigan. And I thought I wanted to continue teaching. And I'd already had this book contract for what is now Twirl. I didn't know that's what it was going to be. It was due at the end of the year of 2016, I believe. Mm-hmm. And I'd taken a job in Detroit teaching sixth grade English, and loved the kids, loved the topics that I was teaching. But the school was just a hard school to be in. My philosophy, I think, of teaching this idea of stories as exploration, as not needing to know the answer right away, didn't line up with what the school's philosophy, I think, was. But at the time, I think with the move and the school, I was just going through a really hard time. And my editor, who is a lovely person and very caring, told me, everything you're turning in is just falling flat and you need to take a break. And so that was devastating for me. And I ended up leaving the job mid-year, which was difficult for me. It's even difficult for me to now to admit that that's what I did, but I did it. And she said, why don't you write about Romeo and Juliet when you were teaching it to the eighth graders the year before? And I told her I did not want to do that. It was going to be way too painful because it was going to be me writing about what I wanted to teach, you know, how I wanted to teach, and it was going to be too painful. But she
painful why?
Because I didn't have that anymore. You know, I didn't. I didn't.
Like drawing it out of yourself would have been just a painful process.
I think so. I think remembering how it used to be was going to be, or what I'd lost, or
because it was such a good experience.
It was such a great experience, okay, and I wanted to, and I still wanted to do it.
Yeah.
But I didn't think, and I still am unsure, that I fit into education as it is presented, at least in Michigan, today. I'm not sure that, you know, I fit in with the standardized testing model and things like that. So you know, it was just a real heartbreak. It was a real, I tell people, it's just a real bad breakup. It's been a bad breakup. So I didn't want to do it. But she kept asking in her gentle, persistent way. And so one day I decided, I came up with this story. You know, I remembered my first kiss and I thought, okay, you know what, this is what I'm going to write about. And she's never going to take it. Cause I thought I was being belligerent and snarky. And she wrote back, a couple days later and said, Callie's back. This is what I want. This is the Callie I'm looking for. Hmm. And she said, how much of this could you write? Cause I thought it was just going to be an essay. We were going to do like a blog series or something. Mm-hmm. And I said, well, I could just go through my lesson plans and probably come up with 20, 25 of these same things. And she said, all right, let's make an outline. And then she said, what else would you want to do? And I said, well, I could do The Hobbit. I could do To Kill a Mockingbird. Mm-hmm. She said, all right, let's make this book series. So she drew up a contract, and this was my first book. So I sent it to her, kind of a chapter at a time. Mm-hmm. And that's how it came to be. So, and it was very therapeutic. It at least made me articulate what I love about teaching and what I believe about teaching stories. So, mm-hmm. so that was, I'm thankful for that.
So you say it helps you articulate what you love about teaching and about stories, but then you also say that in many ways you don't feel like you fit in with, sort of contemporary education standards or practices. And you you said it in some ways it feels like a bad breakup between you. And I took you to mean between you and that sort of education. Was that?
Yeah.
How do those two things relate to each other? Because you said it helped you understand what you love about teaching, but then also you're having this breakup with the way contemporary teaching typically works. So
what
is it that you love about teaching that doesn't fit with the way most teaching happens now?
Well, what I saw and I guess what I see in teaching is a lot of, I feel like there's a lot of fear in teaching now.
It's anxiety driven, you mean?
Yeah. Okay. We have to make sure that these outcomes, and I understand why. I mean, the literacy rates are very low. And we got to do something about that. But I want to do it through a story that children love. And I want to help them draw that out of themselves. I want them to take stories and be able to, read them because they're excited about reading them, not because they have to read them. I'm just not sure I can give what it takes to do that in a classical, or maybe not classical, but maybe public education environment. It's there's just so much that needs to be done, and I'm just not sure I have the skills as a mother now, and I also want to write to do all of that. It's all encompassing, and I think that was where the heartache came. Where I was at the other school, it was a part-time situation. I had a lot of time to do deep work. I could change the unit depending on how the class was going. There was time to do that. Whereas in the school that I was at before, and kind of in the school that I'm in now, there's no time to do any of that. And I miss being able to do some real deep thinking, especially as catering it to students, because some classes are going to not be able to read William Shakespeare or Harper Lee or anything the same way another class is going to. I had one class that was really, really rowdy, and they were so different from the other class that I taught. And so I remember thinking, these lessons are not going to be, they're just not going to resonate with these students. And so I think the Folger's curriculum had something on them redoing the play, rewriting the play. The first class was able to do that and present it. And I thought the second class, I'm just not sure. So what I told them to do was to rewrite a story in Shakespeare language, do a whole prompt book out of it, come up with costumes, come up with stage directions, all that stuff. So I had kids do Star Wars. They had Napoleon Dynamite. They rewrote a scene from Napoleon Dynamite, but it was all in iambic pentameter. It was all, and they had costumes.
That's everything. Hard.
It was a riot. Yeah, I know. I was like, go for it. I don't know how you're going to do it, but you know, they did it. And that was, that's the kind of way that I want to teach. I want to take a story and sort of fit it for that particular student. I want them to be able to, I'll do anything to get a kid to resonate with the story.
So you talk about this idea that, you know, there's because of the standards that schools have put in place and the curriculum and the requirements and all the things that you have to kind of teach towards, it makes it hard to to sort of customize your teaching to individual kids or individual classes. So is that what led into your work, your desire to work with, you know, at-risk students and the ability to sort of customize what you're doing with them towards what that specific student needs or their specific situation?
Yeah, well, when I left this other job, I kept my resume in this consortium and I found this one job, and my job is through a grant. And so the way that they wrote it was I would work and maintain the libraries, but mm-hmm. I would also help students that needed help with things like sight words or, you know, whatever it was that they needed. Mm-hmm. So I'm kind of part-time. I run the library, and then I help groups of, you know, anywhere between one and four students. And what I liked about the idea of this job was that I got to work in a library. I really wanted to, I thought that this would be a great place to present stories, to do, to think of stories as play. And that's why I applied for the job, was because I really wanted to work in a library. The at-risk part is not as, it's not as fun for me. It's hard work, not because I can't do it. I'm sitting next to a child that you see is physically sweating, getting these words out. And that's it's humbling. It's good work to do. It's just, I like to be able to do the story part of it and not so much the phonics and that sort of thing. Mm. I'll do it and I'm happy to do it, but, I like the story stuff. Of course, there's an intimacy that happens too. I was working with one student and she was reading through a story, and, she said, was stumbling upon a word and she sounded it out. And then she looked at me and she said, "Mrs. Fine, I only sound out words around people that I trust." And I thought, well, this is quite an honor to be part of that. Yeah. But it's also the way that the school is set up. You know, the fact that I'm in two schools, I feel like I could be much better if I were in one school. I think the impact would be, a lot stronger. But that's just, the money's not going to libraries. And so, you know, they don't have media specialists. They just kind of have these at-risk literacy specialists instead. And we kind of are a jack of all trades, which is fine. But, you know, I just think I'd like to get into something a little more deeper, I think.
Yeah. So this is a podcast that we kind of say is for people who are obsessed with books, for the book obsessed, you know?
Yeah.
And I think you and I obviously share that. So, you know, when you're working with these kids who say things like, you know, "I only sound out words for people who I trust," or, you know, whatever she said, how do you pass on that enthusiasm, that kind of obsession with books? How do you show and prove the value of the books that you love so much to kids who don't have that as a part of their life or haven't learned to value that, or it wouldn't even occur to them, you know?
Yeah.
And I'm sure you're dealing with kids of all different, you know, maybe kids who, you know, ESL kids or kids from all kinds of different, walks of life you know, different, social levels or whatever, you know, you know, different ethnicities, all kinds of different situations. So do you have to do that primarily by, you know, like really building that relationship, or are there some principles that you can kind of use no matter where that kid comes from to help pass on that enthusiasm, help them understand that? Sorry, long-winded question.
No, that's okay. I think my only tool is the story. I will read the story. I will get to know the story. I will present the story as enthusiastically as I can, no matter if it's something like a Mother Goose rhyme or it's poetry or a chapter book, because students love anything. We were doing these intricate Mother Goose dances and beats. And I thought I would never be interested in this song, except these kids just make it so lively. And, you know, we learn rhyming words through it. We learn sight words through it. And, you know, they take that away along with a little dance routine. One thing that I do, especially with second, third, fourth graders and the fifth graders too, is I find the books that are poems, but they follow an arc. So Sharon Creech's Love That Dog, or I think it's Karen Hess's Out of the Dust, Kwame Alexander's, he's got the crossover book. He's got several books that are in prose, but they have all this white space on the page, but it's a story. And so I'll present these books to kids, and I'll read them from a little bit, but I'll always say, you know, I was a terrible student. I did not like to read when I was a kid, partially because nobody ever read. I mean, my parents read to me, but no, the teachers, once I tested into the lower classes, I would get worksheets, and there's nothing more boring than doing a worksheet. Yeah, and so right. I was literally told I can't read those chapter books. I can't, you know, when all the other kids were in these academically advanced classes and they were putting on plays and making posters and doing book clubs, and I was not doing that. So that's probably part of the reason why I don't like to teach to standards, is because it's, you know, it's a memory for me that I don't like to revisit. So I would say, you know, I wish these books were around, or I knew about these books, because, you know, you think there's not that many words on the page, but the characters are strong. It's funny. The dialogue is great. And before you know it, you've read a book. And when I present books like that, there's never enough copies. I mean, there's the waiting list for those kinds of books are, you know, 10, 15, 20 kids long. And so that's one way that I do. And I just read a ton. And I read for children. So I do read a lot of young adult and children's books, because I want to be ready to hand a story to a particular student at a particular time.
Hmm. Where did your love of books get passed on by someone like you working with young you?
yeah. Well, both my parents are huge readers. And so they, you know, they read to me all the time. I lived next door to a library. And I think one of the things about that place was I would go in there, and it wasn't necessarily to check out a book, but I loved hanging out with the librarians, and I loved the organization of the library. And I actually write about a couple of librarians in my other book, and how, you know, the impact that they had on me. They, you know, they let me check the books out for patrons, and they taught me how to shelve books. And I loved the order of that. And then when I got my license, if I wanted to drive the car, I needed to put gas in it. And my mom, who worked in a library in Oak Park, she got me a shelving job at one of the other branches. And I did not want to work there. I wanted to work at the Gap or something, somewhere cool like that.
Yeah.
She got me the shelving job, and I was allowed to wear my Walkman while I shelved books. And what happened was I started reading the spot, you know, the backs of the books. And I remember The Princess Bride was one of the first books that I brought home, because I loved the movie. And I remember waving it around in my kitchen saying, "Did you guys know this was a book?" And I just devoured it. I just loved it so much. So I came to reading late, but no one ever forced it on me. And I think probably the biggest mistake that was made was that I was told I couldn't handle those books. You know, I needed to do these worksheets first in order to understand a story. And I think I already had an understanding of it, but I didn't, you know, they wouldn't let me read the Judy Blume and Beverly Cleary and all that. I had to go out and do that myself. So thank goodness there was a library next door where I could do that.
So, you know, you're in your bio, it says you know, even MFA from Seattle Pacific University. Did you?
Yeah.
So how did you end up there? So take me through your journey and your love with books, because you ended up making a career out of it, but somewhere along the way, it led to Seattle Pacific, which has that great MFA program.
Mm-hmm. Well, so this is probably all to my dad, but he would, let's see, how did it start? I've known about Image Magazine since it probably started, because it's always been on, you know, our coffee tables, dog-eared, underlined. And so I remember, I think, I don't remember reading it much, except beginning on September 11th, there was a piece of art on the cover of the towers. And I can't remember exactly what it was, but I remember thinking, I have so many questions about what is happening with our world. And I went right to that. This was before I was a mother. And I remember reading, well, I think their tagline is, you know, they have the word mystery in it. And I remember thinking, reading an essay about September 11th and thinking, this is definitely a mystery, but there's a lot of peace in the articulation of this mystery, of this horror that's happening. Mm-hmm. And I wanted more. And so I started reading that. I started reading books and culture. That was the other thing that was always on in our living room coffee table, was books and culture and image. And my dad eventually started sending me books from the books and culture and image. So Lauren Winter, I read Girl Meets God. I think the other one I had was God With Us, which is a devotional. And I think they have a Lent one too. Anyway, anything that he sent me, I would read. And then he started calling these people my friends. I've got a new book from your friends. and then I started this blog after my children were born. And I told myself it was a way of just sharing pictures with the grandparents. But really what it was is I wanted to tell a story about motherhood, because it was just all encompassing. I needed to somehow gather my thoughts. And this was a way of me creating from motherhood. And so I was practicing my voice. I was finding my voice. And so the pictures became really fun places for me to tell a story. I was practicing dialogue. I was practicing scene instead of setting. And then eventually I was reading a post on Good Letters. I think they were promoting creative nonfiction. I'd never heard of it. And Lindsay Crittenden was teaching a course through that. And I didn't have to apply to grad school in order to take this course. And so it was right before Christmas, I think, that I told my dad, this creative nonfiction, this is what I want to do. And so for Christmas, he gave me that course. And it was like finding a friend. I'd never heard of creative nonfiction. I didn't know what it was, but that's basically what I was writing towards.
Yeah.
And so in frantic email one night, I emailed Lindsay and said, I know this course is ending, but I don't want it to end. What can I do? I want to do what you're doing. And so she said, well, you can think about applying for grad school. My dad had been giving me a brochure for Seattle Pacific University for years, saying that I should apply. And I thought, no, I don't want to do that. I'm not that great of a student. I don't want to go back to school. Anyway, I did, but Seattle Pacific University was the only grad school that I applied to. It was the only one that I was interested in going to, particularly because I wanted to work with Paula Huston and Lauren Winter and Jean Marie Walker. Yeah. I wanted to work with her too. And I wanted to figure out more about this whole faith and art business. I liked that. I think they said that we did have to write a testimony for, what our testimony was, but they said that almost like they were hoping that we were grappling with something. We want to see the mystery in your faith. And I really liked that a lot. I really liked that they were okay with somebody who had doubts, who doubted, I like that word, grappled with their faith. So.
Yeah. Yeah. People who didn't feel like they have the answers to everything.
Yes, that's what I wanted. I was looking for somebody who was okay with not answering a question and telling more stories. And I really learned about good writing. And I also wanted to be a good reader. I wanted to be a better reader. I wanted to read those things. I love young adult literature, but that's sort of my go-to. I wanted to challenge myself. I wanted to read Walker Percy and Flannery O'Connor and all those greats.
So did you have your girls at this point?
I did. And I felt horrible about that because actually for our anniversary, our 10th anniversary, my husband bought me another course in Bethesda, Maryland, which was about 20 minutes away from where we lived. And I think the course was called Writing Motherhood, and it was 10 o'clock on a Tuesday. And I said, I can't do this. You know, I'm a mom. I got to stay home with them. And he told me, and I say this all the time, because it turned everything around for me. He said, you're always a mother. You're not only a mother. And, from there I took off. And so, I took that course. I just took as many courses as I could. I came up with a writer's group that we met once a month, and we read each other's work and held each other accountable. I did anything I could to learn. And then I went to grad school.
Yeah. So did you, So you're a mom and you're taking this MFA, going to this MFA program at the same time.
Yeah.
And, you know, I know the Seattle Pacific MFA is a low res program. So you're able to go to these retreats a couple times a year.
Yeah. But yeah.
Did you find that, being a mom while doing this study, did you find that there was dissonance in that, or did you find that it was somehow, enlightening your work, and maybe the work was enlightening your mothering at the same time?
Yeah, that was, I do have to say, I felt a little ashamed. I wasn't the only mother in the group, but I was the oldest person in the group at the time. I think it was a real low point when I realized I was older than Lauren Winter. I thought, oh man, I should have figured all this out before I had kids. but I did have a really good friend, Jill Reed, who is a wonderful poet and a professor in a Louisiana school. We talked a lot about motherhood and writing and this idea that, it was more than just mommy blogging. I know it's a big phrase right now, but we felt there's so much there to motherhood, and I felt more creative after becoming a mother and more urgency to write after becoming a mother than I did beforehand. And I actually ended up writing more. I always said, oh yeah, I'm going to write a little bit here and there. And I never did. But once I had Hadley and Harper, I had to do it. It was something that I just had to do.
So can you talk more about that? Like, you have this compulsion, but this compulsion seems to have increased. I don't know if compulsion is the right word, but it sounds like it. But so after you have the girls and you enter that phase of your life, this compulsion increased, it became more profound.
Yeah, absolutely.
Where do you think that was?
I think it was me trying to figure things out. I remember when I was trying to get Hadley down for a nap. She was like 4 or 5 months old. And, you know, that was just a baffling task for me, is get these kids to sleep.
I understand this problem.
Oh my goodness. And it, you know, I was so tired of this defining my day. I thought, oh gosh, this is just terrible. But, I did have a blog for set up, and I remember putting her in the crib and she was crying. I remember the pediatrician just said, you know, let her see what happened, you know, try 5 minutes, then try 7 minutes, and then try 9 minutes, and see if you can, you know, let her cry it out for a little bit. Something that just sounded horrifying to me. But I wrote while Hadley cried, and even though it was for 5 minutes, I remember thinking, there's something more than just this conflict. I could get the conflict down, but there was also something fun, maybe not fun, but joyful in articulating what was going on in my day, and feeling like I could create from anything. I could create from the pain and the motherhood was a lot like being in a suspense movie. You know, you're like, I'm not sure what's going to happen next. There was something wonderful about that. And it made me feel like I could put one foot in front of the other. And it's the same. It's the same now. I don't only write about my children, but I also find that I can explore memories from my childhood and make sense of those because of Hadley and Harper. And so, you know, if something happens to Harper in fourth grade, I can go back and think, okay, you know, this is how I handled it, or this is how my mom handled it. And there's a story for that. And, so I think that's where the urgency came from. And just seeing them create, seeing them play around with stuff is very inspiring as well. Makes me feel like I can create too. And I think that's a big part of, my, I don't know if manifesto is the right word, but, I do believe in God, and I believe that, we are made in His image. And since He is a creator, I think it's important that we find ways to create too. I think that's part of being in communion with Him. And, so writing is certainly, a witness. I don't really know if that's what my writing is, but I know that God is with me when I am writing. And so I'm offering it up to Him and to others.
The activity itself is kind of a witness. Yeah. Mm-hmm. So do your girls, are your girls bookish, so to speak?
They are.
Not insultingly.
Yeah. No,
it's a compliment.
They read. Hadley does have a phone now, which is the bane of my existence.
How old is she?
She's 12.
Okay.
Going on 17. But she that was the thing in middle school, and
yep.
And so I'm doing my best to not be horrified by it. But she doesn't. You know, we're pretty strict about you know, her usage of it. It all goes away at a certain time, and those phones are locked away. And she reads before bed, and she reads in the morning, and she's always reading. So that's nice. We're in a mother-daughter book club, which is I love. We're reading all kinds of great stories and talking about them, and that's been really helpful.
How does that work out? So you have like just a group of mothers and their daughters, and how
it's six and seven. Actually, it's seventh grade girls. Hadley's in sixth grade, but a neighbor of mine asked me once if I wanted to join, and I said absolutely. And so they picked a bunch of books at the beginning of the year, and then once a month we rotate houses. And who's ever hosting is the one who sort of facilitates the discussion. And there's all sorts of creative ways. They write a bunch of questions and pick them out of a cup, and we read from them, and the girls answer. And, you know, they're not comprehension questions. They're, you know, how do you relate to these books and things like that. So it's fun. It's fun to hear from the girls. And it's fun to hear from the moms. We can all relate. It's a great way to relate to each other. So, so that's very helpful.
Yeah. Books have a way of kind of like washing away differences sometimes.
Yeah. And also, and this is what I found in teaching, is it's a lot easier to talk about a character than yourself. And so if this character is going through something and somebody happens to say, oh, I get that. It's nice to be able to walk yourself alongside of that character without saying, I'm going through this. It allows for a lot of conversation, and I'm thankful for that.
What kind of books do you do in that?
Let's see. We've read my name, A Girl Named Eva. I think it's EVA. I'm not sure if it's Eva or Eva. That was a historical fiction about World War II and a town that was raised by Hitler, and families were separated, and this child, along with a couple others, because she looked the way they wanted the next race to look, got put into another family, and a German family, and was separated from her family. It was based on history and a lot of facts. This author went to the town. I think it was in Czechoslovakia. So we read that book. That was a hard one to get through, but allowed for great discussion because the girl was 12, 13 years old, I believe. And, you know, a lot of the girls could relate to identity, and they couldn't believe that anything like this could happen. And so, you know, that was another way, a great way to discuss those things and what's going on in the world today. And So we've read that book. We've read a book called Matched, which is a series, which is almost like The Giver, except, I think their tagline, somebody who endorsed it said it's like The Giver, except sexier. So there's a love triangle and it's definitely there. You know, you got to have that love triangle for a young adult, I think. So there's that, but the premise is a grandfather who dies on a schedule. You know, I think he takes a pill, just like in The Giver, they have a releasing ceremony. He gives a poem to his granddaughter, and he's not supposed to have that poem. The society has specific kinds of poetry and specific kinds of stories that you're allowed to hang on to. And this was not of it. And it was, do not go gently into that good night. And so so the whole premise is, you know, what do I do now that I have this poem? What does it mean to rage? And so things start happening from there. So that was a really good one. We've read a creative nonfiction one written by a journalist called the 57 Bus. I don't know if you know about this one, but it's, it happened in Los Angeles, and, I'm not going to say the terminology right, but a person who didn't identify as either male or female got onto a bus, and another boy got onto the same bus and lit this person's skirt on fire, and the person suffered major burns. But it's the story of the person who didn't identify or doesn't identify as a male or female. And then this other boy who, had a pretty rough life as well. And just their, how the events surrounded each of those, how that affected this one event affected their lives. And so the journalist goes,
so it's a true story.
It's a true story, yeah. And the journalist goes before, you know, she writes about before what happens before the event and after the event. This one was a really good story because, well, it got a lot of discussion because the group of girls were very invested in both stories. And I liked that because the person who didn't identify as neither male or female ended up, I think, going to Stanford and was a very successful student. The other person wasn't a successful student up to that point. But then you looked at the family life and also the schools that he was in. And then, he ended up going to I think it was a juvenile detention. Maybe it might have been jail. I can't remember exactly. But the girls were invested in both of these stories. And so they were, I thought that was really great that it wasn't like a good guy, bad guy kind of situation. They were concerned just as much as from the one person as the other person. And so that was nice.
Okay. So I've kept you for quite a while, but I wanted to go back just quickly before we leave to the season diaries, because so it seems like a lot of what you've been describing here and how books have, you know, carried you along or been such an important part of your life, that becomes, you know, it seems like it certainly inspired, you know, what you're doing in this book and in this series of books. Mm-hmm. And so do you set out when you're teaching something like Romeo and Juliet or To Kill a Mockingbird or something. Mm-hmm. Do you set out, I mean, do you have it in your head that you want that same sort of thing to happen with your students? I mean, is that one of your primary goals that you want your students to make books a part of their lives the way you do? And so then it becomes sort of inspiring, that becomes a key part of the curriculum, the way you interact with the curriculum and the students? Or is it something where you just, you mean you hope that happens, but you can't, there's nothing you feel like you can do to sort of push the students that way? Does that, I mean, is, I guess the question is, do you think that there are ways of pushing is kind of maybe not the right word, but sort of inspiring your students to have the same sort of relationships with books? Or is it just, you know, is it sort of a mysterious thing?
Yeah, I always, my hope is always that they're going to interact with the book and that book will become a part of them in some way. I think that's probably what drives me to to teach a story in the first place, is that my hope is they will have a story to take with them, and that will help them in their lives, no matter who they are, no matter where they're from, no matter what their academic history or future is going to be, that they can always return to that story and a numerous amount of stories to and to live their lives by. And so that's the expectation that I have. How I go about doing that, I'm not always sure. I remember one year with To Kill a Mockingbird, there's a scene in the story where you know something terrible is about to happen, probably where Bob Buell comes and tries to murder the kids. And you can tell that suspense is happening. And I had a group of kids one year that were just, they felt this passage and they wanted to write just like that. And so we annotated it. We said, you know, what is making this scary? Because she never says this is going to be a scary part or I was afraid or anything like that. So I was not planning on that. And so I said, all right, let's try some scary paragraphs, but you can't use scary. You can't use blood. You can't use knife. You know, you gotta make the reader feel afraid. And I was not planning on doing that, but you know, this class wanted to do it. So I'm like, let's do it. So we turned the lights off because I love writing in the dark, and that's what we did. And then we had a little writer's workshop, reader's theater, where they shared their work. And, these kids would never do that beforehand. So, you know, I'm thankful for Harper Lee because she made them want to write scary stories.
I think that the thing about writers is you either need to be outside in pure natural light or it has to be super dark and moody. There's only those are the only options for writers.
Yeah, you can't either or. I know I read Annie Dillard's book where she talks about writing. She goes into her little cabin and takes a stone and just starts worrying it until her eyes adjust. And I'm like, gosh, that's terrible. I pour myself a cup of coffee and sit there, but I don't want to rub a stone. But yeah, everybody's got their own thing of why they do it.
Yeah. Well, listen, thank you so much for spending some time. I enjoyed the conversation. And
thank you for having me. This was fun.
So you've got The Teacher Diaries and you've got Twirl. Where is the best place for people to go check those books out? Amazon, through the publisher? Yeah, what's the best?
Amazon is the best place. If you're in Calvin, I know the books at Calvin College, and I think it might be at Schuler's Books in Grand Rapids too, but nice. Amazon is probably your best bet.
All right. Well, good luck with those books. And again, thank you for taking the time. And where should people follow you? Follow you on Twitter, Facebook? What's the best thing?
Twitter, my blog is CallieFine.com, and I'm on Instagram too. So all the social media outlets.
All right, great. Well, again, thanks so much for taking the time and for chatting with me.
Thank you. This was fun.
Well, many thanks to Callie Fine for joining me on this episode of Libromania. Head over to CallieFine.com, and that's CallieFeyen.com to learn more about her work. And remember, The Teacher Diaries, Romeo and Juliet is available on Amazon.com now. Thanks to you for listening. Don't forget to follow us on Instagram and Twitter at Close Reads Pods. If you like this episode and the show, please hit the review button in whatever app you're using to listen. It goes a long way in helping us spread the word, which of course means we can keep making more episodes like this one. For all of us here at the Close Reads Podcast Network, I'm David Kern. Thanks for listening. Happy reading, and we'll talk to you next week.